This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, inside the strategy to get Kamala Harris to the White House.
America, hope is making a comeback.
It's the fourth quarter. We're down a field goal, but we're on offense and we've got the ball. We're driving down the field.
Because of you, we've had one of the most extraordinary 4 years of progress ever, period. When I say we, I mean Kamala and me.
America's ready for a new chapter. America's ready for a better story.
And boy, do we have the right team. Kamala Harris is top. Kamala Harris is experienced, and Kamala Harris is ready.
We are ready for a President Kamala Harris.
America, we are not going back. We are not going back. We are not going back.
This week, Democrats rallied around their new ticket, Vice President Kamala Harris and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. It was a remarkable sign of unity for a party that only settled on their new nominee just 4 weeks ago and has been riding a wave of voter enthusiasm. But can this energy last? And what will it take to really win the White House in November? We posed this same question to Atlantic reporter Tim Alberta at the end of the RNC about what it'll take for the Trump campaign. And today we bring it to my colleague Gideon Resnick, who's been at the DNC all week. Hey, Gideon.
Hey, Shamita. How's it going?
Good. So tell me, what has it been like at the Democratic National Convention? What have you seen?
First and foremost, it feels like Democrats are having some fun again. You know, I think this election was starting to feel for them sort of like a funeral march towards a day in November that much of the American public was telling pollsters they did not want at all, a matchup between two candidates that they were frankly not excited about. That has been completely turned on its head in a month. And really, you could hear it all week, but especially Thursday night when Vice President Harris took the stage at the DNC and formally accepted her party's nomination.
On behalf of everyone whose story could only be written in the greatest nation on earth, I accept your nomination to be President of the United States of America.
And what was interesting to me as well is that within that exuberance, within that excitement from the Democratic Party, they don't think that the election is done. In fact, many people have cautioned that they feel like they are still behind and they want people to think that they are still underdogs.
I just want to underscore here, because it is really important to take this in, it has been such an unusual lead up to this convention, right? I mean, Harris entered the race on July 21st, just about a month ago. She had just a few weeks to really own the top of the ticket, and Democrats quickly rallied behind her. And here we are today as the convention is about to wrap up.
I spoke to Jasmine Wright about this. She is a reporter with Notice. It's a new nonpartisan outlet from the Al Britton Journalism Institute in D.C.
If you were to just go back and place yourself at the end of 2019, when she dropped out, I think it was December 2nd, how upset and sad people were, how upset her campaign was about it just not working out, to now, right, raising more than $500 million in 4 weeks, coalescing the Democratic Party that was so fractured in 36 to 48 hours, looking so confident on the stump. I mean, that is just a surprising whiplash moment that I'm like, holy cow, this is pretty insane.
It's sort of a trope in American politics the last 10 years or so for people to say unprecedented, but unprecedented is the word that you hear people saying often at this convention. This is the first time an incumbent president has ever dropped out of a presidential race this close to when the votes are actually going to be tallied. Of course, in 1968, President Lyndon Johnson at the time said that he was not going to seek re-election. That was in the midst of the Vietnam War, but that was more than 6 months before the election was set to take place. It was not a matter of weeks. And I think in the midst of Democrats kind of feeling this exuberance and excitement right now. It's actually been manifested in a lot of the conversations that you're hearing from people this week at the Democratic National Convention, saying they feel like the energy is matching what happened in 2008 when President Obama was running for the first time. Mm-hmm. It's not exactly the same. There are some key differences, specifically in polling on that. But when we were talking earlier this summer about the possibility of an open Democratic convention, all this chaos, all this angst, we are in a different situation now.
Yeah, sure. Gideon, you mentioned earlier that the campaign is really still talking about being underdogs. Well, is that actually true? Like, what does the polling say at this point?
Yeah, in terms of the polling, nationally speaking, Harris has a pretty small lead. It's probably within the margin of error in most of these polls. Trump is doing slightly better in some of the swing state polling than he is overall, and that is where the election is going to be decided in the Electoral College. People don't need to be reminded that in 2016, when Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by around 2 points, she still lost the election. Mm-hmm. But the key thing here is the movement from where Biden was against Trump to where Harris is now against Trump. Mm-hmm. Harris is doing better with a number of voting groups than Biden was when he was the candidate against Trump. The New York Times broke down in their polling where these gains were happening relative to Biden. They were largely among young, non-white, and female voters, and they were relatively smaller among older voters and white men, so far at least. Mm-hmm. So given all of that, right, what we know about these subgroups, what we know about national polling, swing state polling, this basically feels to a lot of people like a 50-50 race at this stage. So really anybody's to win, but not where the party was earlier this summer.
Right, right. Okay, so let's talk about the Harris campaign, who she has assembled on her team so far. I mean, just break it down for us. Mm-hmm. Who is running the campaign and what is their playbook like?
Yeah, I asked this to a lot of reporters that have been covering the campaign and the convention, and they told me there just really hasn't been enough time for Harris to kind of generate a campaign all on her own. Here's Jasmine Wright again.
Right now, they are building the plane as it flies. I've had so many people close to the vice president say those exact words to me.
That is the theme of this campaign on this compressed timeline, for sure. Mm-hmm. It's really a merging of many different groups of people into this campaign, right? So in one group, you have some members of the Biden team. That includes people like Jennifer O'Malley Dillon, who is the campaign chair. She ran Biden's 2020 campaign, so she has a proven track record of winning there. Because this Harris campaign was built so quickly, they have effectively become the Harris campaign now, right? What was the Biden campaign is now the Harris campaign. Additionally, you have some people that are from the Obama team. That's David Plouffe, who ran Obama's campaign in 2008. That's obviously considered one of the most successful campaigns in Democratic modern history. So it's a mixture here of a lot of known entities, people that are tried and tested in Democratic politics. And then in a third camp, you also have a lot of people from Harris's relationships in California. You also have members of her family. That includes her sister, Maya, who some of the reporting in Harris's 2019 primary campaign actually made it seem that Maya was a bit of a problem in terms of organizational structure there, how they were delegating things, what her role was. There's also Maya's husband, Tony West. He's a senior lawyer at Uber and was previously in the DOJ under Obama. Mm-hmm. So overall, this team is described by the New York Times as being more diverse, but also more sprawling than what ended up being kind of this core small network of advisors that Biden was talking to towards the end of his campaign.
Right.
Here's what Gabe DiBenedetti, who's reported extensively on Biden and Democratic politics for New York Magazine, told me about this.
There are a lot of people around Harris who are not necessarily, again, the biggest names, but who've been in Democratic politics for quite some time and are trying to guide her through this very strange moment. And never before, or not in the modern era at least, has someone had to essentially mount a full campaign by taking over their predecessor's campaign infrastructure and run this full thing 3 months through to the end. So she's relying on old friends. That's the short version of it.
Now, it's true that no one has ever really done this exact kind of thing in the way the Harris campaign is doing on such a short timeline, this real sprint to the finish. But if any campaign is going to be able to do it, it might be one that has raised this tremendous amount of money. Reuters reported that the Harris campaign raised $500 million in a month. And I know we've been tossing out words like unprecedented, astronomical, et cetera, and so forth, but it really is crazy. Mm. And Politico had this eye-popping stat. So more people contributed to the Harris campaign in her first 10 days as a candidate than for President Biden's entire 15-month campaign. If you look at it in a month-to-month comparison, Biden's best month was June of this year, and that was around $127 million.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about how the fundraising has all been going, because all we see is these kind of blockbuster headlines.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is coming from kind of individual subsets of groups that are organizing on their own. You know, mere hours after Biden dropped out, Black women organized a Zoom call to kick off some of these fundraising efforts. That brought in about $1.6 million in 2 hours. We saw a lot of other groups start to do the same. Basically, any permutation of kinds of people you could think about were doing Zoom calls. White Dudes for Harris brought in $4.5 million. Cat Ladies for Kamala, Out for Kamala Harris, South Asian Women for Kamala Harris, you know, et cetera, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And one thing that the Harris campaign is pointing out is that a lot of what they are bringing in, they say, is coming from first-time donors, which, again, is another marker of enthusiasm and excitement.
And feels very Obama era.
Feels very Obama era, exactly. And the Wall Street Journal reported that when Biden was the nominee, his campaign could charge something like $10,000 for a photo of him with a donor. Now, if we're going to draw a contrast here to Harris, they recently charged $50,000 for the same offering at a fundraiser in San Francisco.
So tell me a little bit more about what's happening on the Trump side of things. How's fundraising going for the Trump team?
Yeah, in part, there was a stretch where the Trump fundraising apparatus was doing much better than President Biden's apparatus. But now, Democrats have entered the month of August with about $50 million more in cash on hand. That's basically what they have available to them compared to the Trump campaign. And then in the weeks since Harris has entered the race, she's outraised Trump by more than 2-1. So really, again, another sign of how things are moving here.
Okay, so it's good to have money, but then you need to have a plan for mm-hmm. what to do with it, right? Mm-hmm. So what is the Harris strategy here?
Ground game. They are setting up field offices across the country in many states. They also have volunteers that are doing the sort of traditional door knocking phone bank work that we know historically has proven to help in winning elections. Mm-hmm. In addition to ground game, you know, the Harris campaign is able to spend unbelievable amounts of money on ads, something like $200 million in digital ads. That's the largest in presidential campaign history. There's hundreds of millions more for TV in swing states in the fall. We should also say, you know, Trump is successful in the digital ad space as well. A lot of their efforts have been targeted at young men specifically. We saw some polling that seemed to indicate that was helping them. But Shumita, the other thing we always talk about is there's the campaign infrastructure, but then there's also the person that is at the center of the campaign. And with Harris, they're able to do things that they just could not do with President Biden. So one aspect worth paying attention to is Harris's relationship with Black sororities. For our listeners who aren't familiar, these are really, really powerful organizations. And Harris herself is a pledged member of AKA Alpha Kappa Alpha, which mm-hmm. could turn out to be a big force in this election. Here's how Jasmine Wright explained their power.
They meet every year. They meet multiple times a year. They socialize with each other until they get older. It is a group of very dedicated women who want to expand their power. I mean, if you think about in 2020, when Biden first selected Harris, they all donated 1934. I believe those are the years that they created the organization. And that amounted to hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? And so that's just like the small power of what they're able to do.
So I know the polls show Harris is expected to do very well with Black women. Who else can we expect to be in the Harris coalition? Like, what kind of voters are they going after?
Yeah, I mean, really, since 2008, Democrats have tried to recreate that kind of mythic Obama coalition, right? That, of course, didn't work in 2016, but Biden had his own coalition in 2020 that propelled him to victory. So right now, the Harris campaign challenge is at least rebuilding that or something like it. And, you know, one of the big issues before Biden dropped out is that the polling among a lot of traditionally pretty reliable Democratic voters had really started to erode, specifically among Black and Hispanic men. I mean, Biden was polling at something like 77% among Black voters at certain points, which is significantly worse than the 92% that he won among Black voters in 2020. A lot of that was a lot of Black men indicating that they were starting to defect from the Democratic Party. And depending on where you look now, what numbers you look at now, Harris is sitting somewhere between 82 to 84%. Mm-hmm. So that's already a big gain, not quite at the 2020 levels that we saw. There's also some polling that's showing some ground being made up among Hispanic voters. But the main thing that appears to be happening so far, in addition to those groups, is that Harris is polling well among women, young voters, and doing better than Biden among rural and white non-college educated voters so far. And what all in all that means is that some of these numbers are starting to return to baselines where the Democratic Party thinks they can win a presidential election.
Mm. So help us think about this in terms of the electoral map, right? We've heard so many times this week that it's no longer just about the blue wall, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So what states are they targeting? And what is the math looking like right now?
Yeah, to that point on the blue wall that gets talked about all the time, when Biden was still in the campaign, they were saying that basically their only path to winning the Electoral College was to hold on to those states, to narrowly hold on to them. Mm-hmm. With Harris, the campaign sees a lot of different pathways to get to that magical 270 number. And that is because she is more competitive among some of these voting groups that we just talked about. Some of these voting groups that are in states like Georgia, mm-hmm. like Arizona, like Nevada, and like North Carolina. If the electoral results match up with some of the polling that we're seeing there right now, that means that they have a lot more options to basically get to that number, which is where every campaign wants to be. You want to have more ways to win than only a very, very narrow path to lose.
Sure.
That is all to say, though, the Harris campaign does not think that this is anywhere near close to done. They're not getting smug about any of this. They still are acting like they want to fight for every single vote. I talked to Eugene Daniels from Politico when we were at the convention, and here is how he put it.
I think largely it's about the campaign believes it's just about like just getting to the finish line. And for her, like she keeps telling them, we're the underdogs. Act like the underdogs. When you act like you're the winner, you start to get complacent. She's always said to aides behind closed doors that we're not going to lose to Donald Trump. If we're going to lose, we're going to lose to the couch. And that was even when she was the running mate. And so that concern about not getting people out, I think that maybe that's their they see as their biggest vulnerability, is like getting people out to vote in a time in which they were feeling so beat down by politics.
Right. So to that concern about people not turning out to vote, let's talk about pro-Palestinian Democrats who are upset with the Biden administration and its handling of the war in Gaza. In the primaries, we saw hundreds of thousands of Democrats vote uncommitted. That was their way of sending a clear message to Biden that if he doesn't pivot on Israel policy, he could lose their votes in November. Mm-hmm. We've all been sort of braced this week to see what kinds of protests might pan out at the DNC. What have we seen, and where does this group of voters sit now?
Yeah, Shumita, I mean, broadly, this was not a week of tremendous protest presence, at least, you know, not what people were envisioning before it started, particularly not inside the convention center. But it is really notable that we are just about 10 miles from one of the largest Palestinian American communities in the United States. And that community wants to be heard by this Democratic Party. The uncommitted movement itself says that they are advocating for a ceasefire. The administration is talking about actively working on that, as they have. The movement also says that they want an arms embargo, which Harris has already said that she would not support. And then outside of these policy questions, they asked this week to be given a spot at the convention, which the DNC did not acquiesce to. And actually, Mother Jones got a copy of the speech that would have been given, and it's actually relatively tame in a lot of ways. It was written and intended to be delivered by a Georgia state representative. And she says in it, in part, quote, "Let's commit to each other to electing Vice President Harris and defeating Donald Trump, who uses my identity as a Palestinian as a slur." So the movement didn't get to speak, but Harris, of course, addressed the conflict in her speech on Thursday night. Kind of familiar territory for this administration. She started by defending Israel.
And let me be clear. I will always stand up for Israel's right to defend itself, and I will always ensure Israel has the ability to defend itself.
And then, as she has in the past, Harris also spoke to the humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
At the same time, what has happened in Gaza over the past 10 months is devastating. So many innocent lives lost.
desperate, hungry people fleeing for safety over and over again. The scale of suffering is heartbreaking.
And, you know, I was in the convention hall during the speech, and this part was particularly well received. And I think it perhaps speaks to both the desire that a lot of Democratic voters seem to have for a ceasefire and the possibility that the ground on this issue is shifting since Harris took over the ticket.
So that was one of the big concerns for the campaign headed into this week. What other policy vulnerabilities would you say the Harris campaign is looking at this stage?
Yeah, I mean, there are two obvious ones. Voters have been unhappy with the economy under this administration. They often favor Trump on economic issues and immigration. That comes up in polling a lot. And that is where the Harris campaign feels like they have weaknesses and where they are trying to define her more quickly than the Trump campaign can for American voters. Though I will say, Jasmine Wright found something interesting when she talked to some voters about this.
The vice president isn't totally, at this point, tied to the negativity that was Biden's economy. Americans in polling don't necessarily see her as responsible for the policies that they believe, either correctly or incorrectly, led to high prices or things like that, inflation. And so that is an avenue for them to go on the offensive and make their own narrative.
Right. And from the looks of the polling, it sounds like she is successful so far at creating some of that distance. Mm-hmm. So, Gideon, big picture here, what is Harris's message to voters? What is the big pitch?
Yeah, I mean, in Harris's speech on Thursday night, we heard her talk a lot about justice, about being willing to fight for what is right, and really coming back to this constant theme of freedom.
The freedom to live safe from gun violence in our schools, communities, and places of worship. The freedom to love who you love openly and with pride. The freedom to breathe clean air and drink clean water and live free from the pollution that fuels the climate crisis. And the freedom that unlocks all the others, the freedom to vote.
And Shumita, really, we've heard that word all week and throughout this campaign. This word freedom, you know, the song Freedom by Beyonce is kind of the campaign's unofficial anthem. The Washington Post counted the use of that word on Monday night at the convention as being used more than 100 times. So they're really, really driving it home. And I think at the convention, they were wrapping that in a kind of patriotism that honestly used to often be associated with Republican events in the public consciousness. A lot of flag waving, a lot of war hawks took the stage Thursday night before Harris spoke. It really seemed like they were trying to paint a picture of a party that can be centrist and can appeal to even conservative voters, and drawing a contrast to the Trump campaign, saying effectively to American voters that the Trump campaign is a break from American orthodoxy upholding democracy, that taking away reproductive rights represents not respecting the values and personal choices of all Americans, that trying to overturn an election doesn't represent the personal values of upholding people's right to vote. And by framing it up this way, they're trying to create a permission structure to say, look, maybe you don't agree with Kamala Harris on XYZ issue, but this campaign stands for core American principles that a lot of swing voters can get behind.
Yeah, I mean, we can see how they're thinking this through, but I also have to say, I feel like we didn't leave this week with more clarity on Harris's specific policy positions. So, I mean, really, what was this at the end of the day? Was it just a good vibes week? There really isn't that much time left. When are we going to hear her spell things out more concretely?
Yeah, you're 100% right. And every convention, in effect, is a good vibes week for the party.
Sure.
They want to put on a show of things are hunky-dory, things are great. But yeah, for the Harris campaign, there is not a lot of policy specifics that have been concretely mapped out. Here's what Gabe DiBenedetti said about all of this and why, in fact, it might actually turn out to be a kind of strength.
I think that one of the things that Harris has going for her right now is what you might call strategic vagueness, but it might also just be, you know, waiting it out. They haven't announced a lot of policy specifics. They haven't announced, beyond the broadest strokes, what her governing agenda would look like. Again, part of this is because the campaign is so young, and why would they do that now? But there's also this idea that people are really able to project on her whatever they want to see of the future right now. And this is something that very, very good politicians are able to maintain for a long time. Barack Obama, for example, was sort of famous for having everyone believe that he stood for what they wanted him to stand for.
And also, Eugene Daniels echoed that sentiment to me and put it this way.
Democrats often want to hear policy. They're a bunch of nerds. They love a white paper. But I think the campaign, and more importantly, like Democrats around them that are so excited, they're like, maybe we could just like vibe our way to the election, right? That's not what the electorate is looking for right now. They could be wrong.
And I've got to ask this because just a few weeks ago when the RNC wrapped, Republicans left there feeling extremely confident. Mm-hmm. And Tim Alberta described it to us as almost like a victory party there. And we saw the wind come out of their sails real quick. How long do you think Democrats can ride this wave?
That's what Democrats are asking, I think, for sure. You know, I think that the next key moment and the next key test is going to be that presidential debate. That's going to be another moment where the Harris campaign is going to have to try and keep this momentum up, where they are going to have to talk about policy and they are going to have to draw that contrast on September 10th. So there are a few big moments left for them in this short timeline, and they're going to try to have to keep riding that wave.
Gideon, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Gideon Resnick, my Apple News colleague, reporting from the Democratic National Convention.